It seems to me like whenever like a really insane religious zealot talks about, the destruction of the family or the country, they always like they go straight for turtles. Maybe it's just because that's the most asexual looking creature ever.
What do you mean they go straight for turtles? Like,
Like it's always, soon we'll be marrying turtles! Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the podcast that regrettably stayed up far too late when he knew he had to wake up early.
Well, why'd you do that, silly?
Well, it's the worst possible situation as well. I discovered this this documentary series on YouTube, done by the BBC. This guy named Louis Theroux. He did these like mini 1-hour docs of him visiting various different groups of people and mostly American like subcultures. And I was just kind of devouring them yesterday and just watching one after the other. And word to the wise, don't stay up till 2 in the morning watching a documentary about the West Baptist or the Westboro Baptist Church, and then decide to go to bed with that being the last thing on your mind.
That's scary.
Yeah. It was very upsetting. I've decided, having after watching several of these docs, that they are, bar none, the most evil people in the world. And I put that above, like, NAMBLA, the Nazis, or terrorists.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Literally, he's interviewing all of these guys, and he has this very kind of funny interview style where he, like, he's just kind of this awkward, sort of nerdy, but in a very approachable, journalist-y sort of way, a British fellow, and he approaches every interviewer, no matter who he's talking to, whether he's talking to, like, a prostitute or a drug addict or a member of the Westboro Baptist Church. He always acts like the very concepts of what they do he's never heard of before. And so he approaches like a Nazi and says something like, "Do you think that somebody might find the swastika to be offensive? Has that ever occurred to you?" But yeah, so he's talking to these kids, and they're like literally children, like 6 years old, talking about how that we should be glorifying God because he's given women breast cancer because of their sin.
Well, okay.
So that was my weekend.
Saying praise Lord for breast cancer, is that?
Yeah, that's their new thing now is praise God for breast cancer.
Oh, well, okay. I don't know what to say beyond that. You're Cassidy Robinson. I got that.
You are Richard Wally.
Yeah, I am.
And today in this podcast we will be reviewing Behind the Candelabra, Man of Steel, which just came out this last weekend, and we'll be reviewing Velvet Goldmine as our Netflix homework. But before we get all of that down, what did you do over your weekend?
I am extra crispy.
Yes. We
went to the beach, and I burnt my little flesh off.
Mm. Because you have that that pasty white thing going on like I do.
Yeah, it's a problem. Well, actually, I don't do so bad in the sun. It's usually the first time I read up a bit, but it was a little overcast, but only a little.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, in that class I took, that science class, they talk about something about refraction and how light rays can be worse through clouds or something. I think that's what they said. Is that what they said? I don't know if that's what they said. Do I need sunblock? I don't need sunblock. It's okay. I needed sunblock.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the thing. I heard something like that, too. It's not so much that it's worse through clouds. It's just that people don't think about it because they're not. It's not as hot, and it's not exposed, so they think they're okay when they're not.
Oh, no, I completely knew that I was exposed.
Yeah.
But.
So you're just like, yeah. You're just fuck it.
Last year I was fine. Like, I didn't burn this bad. We stayed out longer, probably. Uh-huh. So.
Now, these are the coasts of Oregon, so I'm surprised. It's not just constantly raining always.
It's not.
You actually got a little bit of sunshine.
I mean, it rains here, but it's not like, I don't know, it's not like people make it seem like it's like every day for 7 months. It's like it rains a little bit and then it goes away. It's not, I don't know.
It's not the epidemic. You haven't become suicidal because of the lack of vitamin D.
No. Not at all. I prefer the rain to the cold, so. I mean, we get cold rain here, but no snow, really, yeah. That much, so. Like, maybe a week a year, but.
Yeah. It's not snowy anymore. It's actually getting pretty warm in southeast Idaho. Now it's become desert o'clock.
It's become fire o'clock, really.
Yeah. Actually, a few weekends ago when I had to go to one of those things with my parents, I carpooled with them, and as I was pulling up, there's this billowing black smoke coming from behind their house, and I see all these fire trucks, like, down on their road. I'm like, oh my God, their house burning down right now? And then when I got there, it was the hill just on the side of the interstate that their neighborhood is right next to.
Mm.
Like, the whole hill went up in flames, and they didn't want to leave until they got word from the fire people that nobody had to be evacuated.
Sure. We're old people.
Why?
I'm talking about weather. You want to talk about, like, cattle or something else boring?
Yeah, did you clip any really cool coupons this weekend? Oh. Find any good deals?
I'm always clipping coupons. No, no, just had some southern food, burnt my skin off, watched some Man of Steel.
Yeah.
Got it. Had some chicken wings.
Chicken wangs?
Wangs.
All right, well, then we won't delay this further and get to talking about movies, since that's what we're here to do. Movie news. You got some.
I have some. Some being the key word. I'll just get the bad news out of the way real quick.
Okay.
So, apparently, the movie that we've been waiting like 8 years, now it'll be 9 years for, Sin City Part 2, or Sin City A Dame to Kill For, has been pushed back a year to August 22nd, 2014.
Yes.
What the fuck?
Well, it is kind of funny because we were just talking about this last weekend, when we recorded that, how is Rodriguez managing to find time to put out this, Machete Kills, and his ice cream student film thing all at the same time? And I guess that answers that question.
Yeah, the answer is he's not.
The answer is just fuck that.
No, I don't know. Yeah, maybe he just, like, I don't know. I wonder if it's one of those things where he just wants to take more time with it, or he has to go back and do reshoots, or maybe it just really sucked and he's like, I can't put that out, I need another year to get this done.
Well, the way he, you know, does those movies, he can really do all principal photography. For all we know, he probably already has.
Yeah.
And then he can just leave that stuff on a jump drive somewhere and then, you know, finished doing press for Machete Kills and touring that and seeing it through, and then he can go back and green screen all that stuff that he has to do, all the post.
Well, maybe he just, maybe basically he just, like, ran out of money to distribute it.
Yeah.
So he has to be like, well, we're going to have to wait a year until this stuff comes through.
It's like Ed Wood style. He has to go to the Brown Derby and raise money before he can finish the movie.
I think that may be true.
Has to get Vampira to sign on.
I'm not joking, but yes, you're right.
Okay, well, yeah, that's kind of a bummer. I was looking forward to that. Sin City is still, you know, far and away my favorite movie of his, which I guess it's not exactly the most Robert Rodriguez-y through and through, but, you know, in 2005, my age at the time, that was my favorite movie that year.
Huh?
Okay, well, I don't have anything super exciting, other than to say, remember all of that bad press that Only God Forgives was getting at Cannes?
Yeah.
About the booing and the walking out and the tepid reviews. Well, apparently, at the Sydney Film Festival in Australia, it just won the main award there.
The Sydney thing.
The Sydney Award. The Roo, as they call it. I don't know.
Did you say the Roo?
I don't think they...
The Wombat Award! The Wallabe Award! For Best Actress. Okay. That was horrid, but that's the best I got.
I'm not sure what accent that was. Every winner of this festival gets, like, a didgeridoo, a complete functional 12-foot didgeridoo that they have to walk off stage with. Does this restore your faith in Only God Forgives? Were you ever worried in the first place?
I'd always heard that it was just super violent, so that's what people were in such a big hubbub about. I always take anything anybody tells me with a grain of salt, because there's been a lot of bad movies, or bad in quotation mark movies, that I still liked, and there's been a lot of good movies that I thought were crap, so... I don't know. For this specifically, I like the direction. I just heard it was super violent, and that's why they were booing. And I was like, well, you kind of had to know he was going to make a super violent movie if you've seen any of his other stuff.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's at the Cannes Film Festival a while ago, Drive, you know, he won Best Director for that.
Yeah.
And that certainly has its amount of violence. And I think, in general, people know who he is as a director. You know, the Pusher trilogy is pretty well known internationally.
Sure.
So I don't know. I don't know what it means that they weren't having it for this thing. Maybe it's just one of those kind of Hollywood chews you up and spits you out kind of things. It's like, you're our guy 1 year, and then the next year, you know, we're done with you.
Well, the French, you know, I mean, Cannes is, I mean, kind of French. I mean, really, it's from everywhere, but... Specifically, you know, Australia, they made, you know, The Road Warrior and Mad Max and that. So, you know, I don't worry about them. Yeah. If they say it's okay, I probably agree with them.
Well, yeah, that's what, you know, I put a little joke on our, when I posted this on our Facebook page, saying, you know, who knew that the Australians like their ultraviolence more than the French? And I think, you know, there's something to be said about that. I mean, Australia is, you know, other than America, one of the more well-known exploitation generators of the world. And even up to this day, you know, movies like Snowtown Murder and Animal Kingdom and those kind of movies, they have, you know, they like darker, grittier stuff.
Yeah, it's because they're a penal colony.
So yeah. They got rebel blood. I knew it.
I'm just looking away from the screen right now.
Okay, well, the last thing I wanted to really bring up, or I guess we wanted to bring up, was they finally decided to pick a new writer for the Prometheus sequel that we all knew was coming. Jack Pegelin?
Yeah, do you know who that is?
GLEN. He wrote Transcendence, apparently.
Oh, you looked everything up, you little bastard.
I don't know what is Transcendence.
You don't know what that is? That's no. Wally Pfister's. It's going to be his first directorial debut. So literally, Pelican hasn't done anything.
Well, nothing that's come out yet, anyway.
Well, exactly.
So he's has
that's one. That's what I'm saying. What do you base it on?
We have nothing to base it on.
Well, I mean, I guess Wally Pfister, if you can trust. I mean, he's done gorgeous cinematography, so.
Yeah.
Transcendence, Johnny Depp's going to be in it, so.
Okay. Ooh. Yeah, I don't know what any of that means, really.
Johnny Depp is an actor. He's been pretty prolific.
Who is this guy? Yeah, I mean, you know, cool, I guess. We have nothing really to base it on, and we won't know this guy's writing chops until Transcendence comes out.
Well, see, that's the thing. I got excited when I first read it. I was like, oh, they're moving ahead, hopefully, you know. In my mind, it's about Noomi Rapace and Michael Fassbender's head in a bag going on adventures.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that might not be what happens, but in my mind, that's what happens.
Well, do you think...
I don't want it to be attached to anything, ever. I just want it to be a head in the bag.
Oh, I thought you meant this part of the franchise to be attached to anything.
Yeah, that too, that could be interesting.
Just a whole new thing. So everybody got up in arms about Damon Lindelof's screenplay, about, you know, inconsistencies, plot holes, questions that weren't answered, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, science nerds hate that guy, like, hate him.
I think, in general, he's kind of becoming a sour note to people, and I don't necessarily agree with it. I like Prometheus enough. I'm not going to say it's a perfect screenplay, and it's certainly the most problematic aspect of that movie, but sure. I don't think that it is as bad as people make it out to be, and... you know, there's even been a lot of trash talking about Lindelof's involvement in Star Trek Into Darkness, and I don't find much fault with that screenplay at all. So I think people, you know, whether or not it's true or viable, just want to hate on Lindelof right now. So I don't know if they're cutting him out, you know, to, you know, keep people from... judging the movie before it comes out.
I don't know. There was a rumor at best a while ago. I don't know. It's also clipped to this article on the one that we have on our site is from Joe Blow, but this one's on Collider. But they talk about how apparently Fox was freaking out because they didn't know how to continue the story, but it all seemed like kind of like bullshit. Damon Lindelof, he also came out and was like, yeah, I don't think that's true. So
yeah, I guarantee there is, you know, a whiteboard with flow charts everywhere that has this whole thing mapped out. All they have to do really is fill in the dialogue and, you know, some set detail and stuff like that.
Yeah, agreed.
I don't think they would go forward with something this big if they didn't have a pretty good idea where everything conceptually was going.
Also, if, you know, Ridley Scott was like, yeah, I think we should make a sequel. I think they had kind of an idea of where it was going to go. So, I guess we'll see. Who knows?
Well.
Maybe it'll be Transformers 3 again.
Maybe. Actually, weirdly enough, there is some thematic comparison to Transformers 3, 2001 Space Odyssey, and Prometheus.
Oh.
As far as ancient things being buried on the moon.
Oh, fair enough, yeah.
We'll go ahead now, and I will do a quick review of the HBO film Behind the Candelabra, which I was able to see somewhat recently. I don't know if you want to pull the headphones or if you just want to listen in.
Is there a surprise ending? Is Liberace not really gay?
That's the surprise ending. No. Or he's still alive. He was actually abducted by aliens.
Wow, this movie gets weird.
Okay, I'll just go ahead and talk about it for a little bit. So as a lot of people have known, this is supposedly the last film by director Steven Soderbergh, who did, of course, Ocean's 11 and Traffic, Contagion, and Side Effects earlier this year. And he's expressed a lot of doubt in the studio system as of lately, and a lot of disinterest in the medium itself, and has actually talked about how he might be more interested in working in TV. Originally, this film, Behind the Candelabra, a biopic of sorts about the famous piano entertainer Liberace from the he went all the way pretty much from the 40s until the mid-80s. I guess his heyday was probably the 60s and 70s. But this film was originally supposed to be released theatrically, and he was never able to get the funding for it because studios thought it was, using his words, too gay. Or they didn't have a lot of faith in what kind of audience it could draw. So eventually got the funding from HBO instead and was able to release it that way. Surprisingly, though, the movie actually looks pretty cinematic. It's still shot in widescreen. TV shows are shot in widescreen now because everybody has widescreen television. But, it still looks and feels like it's something on the same scale as Ocean's 11. Of course, it isn't action-driven. There isn't as many crazy set pieces. But it feels like a Soderbergh movie, and I could have definitely imagined it on the big screen. And I kind of wish I'd been able to see it on the big screen because it looks really, really nice. Soderbergh always does his own cinematography, and it has that kind of amber hue that a lot of his movies have, and it really kind of is used to sort of a greater effect here because so much of this movie has to do with the artificiality of the Vegas world and the opulence of Liberace as a persona. So the story as it exists is basically about how Liberace, in his older age, played by Michael Douglas, of all people, Falling Down's Michael Douglas, he is entering kind of his twilight years. He isn't quite the star that he used to be, but he's still the highest paid entertainer in Vegas, and he is quite wealthy. Through a friend, he meets Scott Thorson, played by Matt Damon, who's kind of a young drifter living with a foster family and is a dog trainer for Hollywood. They kind of hit it off, and he quickly kind of gets sucked into Liberace's world, and he decides to move in with him. Liberace is very, very generous with his wealth, and pretty much pays for Scott Thorson's affections to move in with him and live with him and even help tour with him being a chaperone. And as their relationship develops, you see, and you go through the last 10 years of Liberace's life with Scott, you see this relationship develop in stranger and weirder and sometimes sweet and sometimes kind of dark ways. Scott gets more involved with drugs. Liberace gets more involved with crazy plastic surgeries. At one point, he even convinces Scott to get a plastic surgery that makes him look like a younger version of himself. And it kind of has this weird balance between being a genuine love story between these two and talking a lot about, like, what it was to be a gay entertainer who couldn't come out at that time, even though he was living in the most transparent closet you could possibly think of. And at the same time, it has this kind of weird Sunset Boulevard-y kind of thing going on where, Scott feels like he can't leave, even if he wanted to, and the relationship is souring, but he's kind of been nailed into this sort of bejeweled, gilded palace that he, feels like he can't escape from. So it's a very strange movie. It's a very funny movie. Rob Lowe is in there, and Dan Aykroyd play very funny walk-on cameos. Rob Lowe is a a very strange looking plastic surgeon, and it balances a lot of crazy moods and a lot of crazy ideas. And I really do think this, had this have been released in October, November, there definitely could have been at least some good acting nominations. Most of all from Michael Douglas, who you forget is Michael Douglas by the first 20 minutes. And as well as Matt Damon, who's really putting it all out there. So I like this movie a lot.
Oh, cool. I'll have to check it out. I mean, I've wanted to, but...
Yeah. It's an odd duck, but I really like it. And I think, you know, especially as a double feature with Sunset Boulevard, that would be a really cool pairing to see how those narratives are kind of working in a similar way. But also, I would say, if I had one complaint about the movie, and it's a minor one, it's that the screenplay is really linear. You know, they say that, you know, if you show a gun at the beginning of a movie, you have to explain why it's there by the end of the movie. In this movie, if you see a gun in the next scene, he's loading it, and then the next scene after that, he's shooting it. Not literally a gun, but in that's the way the writing kind of works. It's very one scene directly affects the other, and that's not necessarily a problem for the movie. But nothing really comes as a surprise.
It's your personal, you don't, the clarity of the...
Yeah, it's kind of an unambitious screenplay, but it's done so well by everyone else involved that it kind of elevates it.
Okay.
All right.
Sometimes we might need unambitious, but...
Well, I mean, it's played just, it's a well-crafted screenplay, and it's a studied screenplay, but it feels a little wooden compared to how I don't know, over the top everything else is. But okay, we'll go ahead now and talk about the movie everyone really cares about, and that is Zack Snyder's Superman reboot, remake, whatever you want to call it, reimagining Man of Steel. Why don't you go ahead and set that up?
Okay. There is an alien who is sent to Earth. I mean, do we really have to explain, like, the Superman origin? Like, I mean, really. Okay, so a space creature who feels alienated from his by everybody comes to Earth as a musician. And, I'm getting confused, aren't I? Did you do that on purpose? I just realized that.
No, I didn't.
You didn't? Well, if you should have taken credit for that. That was ingenious. No, we're not talking about David Bowie. We're talking about Superman.
Yes.
So, basically, he comes to Earth, you know, he grows up in Kansas, stuff happens, and then bad people from his planet come back while he's on Earth, and he has to save everybody. Yep. I mean... Really, that's what the plot is.
If it is a remake, it's...
It has a lot of... What?
I said if it is a remake, it's probably the closest to Superman 2, the plot of Superman 2, which also featured the character of General Zod.
Right.
At that time, played by Terrence Stamp, now is played by Michael Bugnuts Shannon.
Oh, I like that. You know... I have a hard time with this film, actually.
Really?
I don't know if I dislike or like it.
Wow, okay, I'm very interested now.
I think overall, I will say this, overall I think I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But throughout the whole thing, I couldn't be more like, okay, that didn't make any sense. Okay, what the hell is going on here? Or, you know, there's just so many plot holes. Or not plot holes, really, just the logic of it was very stretched thin. Yes, he's an alien, blah, blah, blah. I know, but there was a lot of things where I was like, I'm not sure about that.
What exactly? I mean, we don't want to spoil too much or whatever, but what kind of inconsistencies really snagged you?
Little things like, okay, he's a Superman, you know?
Yeah.
He can withstand 40 degree below weather, but... Lois Lane in her little skimpy outfits running around in the negative 40 below weather outside.
Okay, I actually didn't notice that, but all right.
her reasonings for being in the movie almost.
Really?
Her being on jet planes for who knows why. The aliens playing her out for who knows why. I don't know.
She is weaved into this story in a much more prominent way than Lois Lane has ever been featured before, and it's not necessarily as a love interest, always.
Actually, that was one of the things I had a problem with. They kissed at the end, and I was like, well, I know that they're supposed to be together because it's Superman and Lois Lane. I get that.
Yeah.
But there was like, you know, I don't think they even knew each other's names.
It was kind of the Thor situation.
I thought much worse than the Thor situation. They at least, like, shared a moment. Like, these two, like, literally were like, okay, shit's blown up. Oh, we're going to make out. Shit's blown up. The other thing that I guess kind of bothered me, and it hasn't bothered me in a lot of the other films, is just the amount of devastation.
Yes.
So there's a part in the film where there's this family, and... I don't think this is ruining. This isn't a spoiler. If it is a spoiler, I'm sorry. So there's a part in the movie where Superman saves this family from General Zod. But their epic battle through the city had to have killed millions of people. And why did he give a shit about this family all of a sudden and be like, well, darn, now I have to kill him. Like, I don't know. There was a lot of those kind of things in this movie. Yeah. I actually thought I actually dug the origin story a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the female villain, Ursa. She was just badass.
Okay, I mean, I guess.
Whatever, I thought she was badass. You screw yourself. No, I thought she was really cool. I really like it when they have a really strong female character that's really mean. Okay. I wish they would have developed her more because they just kind of dropped that line, like they dropped a lot of things. There was all sorts of like little things that it was like, okay. I mean, I forgot about them because I'm like, okay, this is a big dumb movie.
Yeah.
But I had to keep reminding myself, okay, this is a big dumb movie, and that became kind of a
problem in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Do you think that the X factor here for your response to Superman is the Zack Snyder thing? Do you think that these are Zack Snyder failings, or do you think that these are screenplay problems, or what, or a mixture of both?
Maybe a mixture. I don't know. And I also kind of came out of it. That's the other thing I kind of came out of. As a rule, I have a rule that if you are into superheroes, you have to at least respect Superman.
Yeah.
And the reason being, I mean, he's he's kind of the godfather of all, you know, of all super beings after that, you know, they all stem from him in some way.
Yeah, he's the archetype.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I understand, I do have the frustration of he does have too many of the toys in his toy box.
Yeah.
Like, he can do everything ever, so, like, there's never a moment where you're like, oh, no. You know, the most you can get is kind of the people around him. Oh, no. And when you're destroying billions upon billions of people, and there's a 3-mile just flat surface of nothing.
Where a city was.
Yeah, where a city was. You kind of get kind of complacent about everybody else in the movie.
Yeah.
But, I mean, some of the... That's another thing that I do have to compliment, though. I did kind of like the story did kind of harken back to, like, it did remind me of Batman Begins in a lot of ways. I did like the stuff about his family and that kind of stuff. I think the kid actor and that stuff was more compelling than in Batman Begins.
Yeah.
I guess the overall, I don't know. Like I said, I kind of have some weird... I have weird feelings about this movie. At one point, there's a child in me that's like, kick ass, and then there's another part of me that's like, ugh, okay, I guess.
All right. Like,
I don't know, I have kind of a mixed feeling about it.
So. Wow, there's Richard, taking the gloves off.
I guess.
No, I'm actively surprised. I mean, Because I was watching the movie and I felt I could Xerox your review and say it's mine. I mean, that's almost directly exactly how I feel about it.
Oh, okay.
For almost the same reasons. Okay, so the movie starts out, whatever, in Krypton, very similar to the first act of the Richard Donner Superman movie.
Okay, random, I'm sorry. I know I talked for a while, but I have to get this out.
Okay.
What was up? Because this is a question for you. So we talk about the first part on Krypton.
Yeah.
Some of the weird Geiger-esque, like, designs, did that bother you at all?
Well...
Did it seem weird to you? Like, some of it I thought was cool, and then some of it, there was this part where they put them in these, like, penis vibrator things, and then send them into the black hole that they open for a second.
So, one of the things you can complain about this movie, is that I think there's a lot of set design that comes from other movies. And I don't think that they were specifically doing anything with that imagery. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they were trying to evoke the same things that, like, Ridley Scott does or you know, any of the people who's used Geiger-esque biomechanical-looking stuff. I think, you know, we have to remember, this might be Zack Snyder's best movie, or at least his most ambitious. But it's still a Zack Snyder movie. And, you know, he is a man about surfaces. That's what he understands best, is how to dress his sets and how to dress his actors. And so, or at least you always get the idea that that's what he's always the most excited about. So I think that's where that comes from. There's a lot of imagery that looks like it comes directly out of The Matrix. There's a lot of imagery that comes directly out of Prometheus and the Alien movies. And then, you know, pretty much the middle act, which is my favorite part of the movie, once we get, you know, we're cross-cutting from the origin story stuff that we all know, the Smallville story, and him trying to sort of find himself as an adult, and this kind of existential journey he's on. The Batman Begins part, or the Superman Begins segment of the film, that feels a lot like a Nolan movie, the way that it's shot and look. And you do get the idea that Nolan and company told him, okay, you can't slow-mo everything. So he did lose that toy out of his toy box. And I think as a result of that, he just decided, okay, well, then I'm just going to blow up everything.
Well, I think it was partially maybe in the script, partially. But
yeah, well, I'm sure.
I think he maybe extrapolated upon it.
I felt very uncomfortable with some of the way a lot of that was shot. And it's interesting that we bring this up, because we just had this discussion on our pet topic only, you know, a few weeks ago about, you know, what if they're going to evoke terrorism and you're going to evoke 9/11 and these kinds of things, is that aiding the film or has it become distracting, blah, blah, blah. And we basically came to the consensus that, you know, it's good to be about your time and place in history and that, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then in this film, it, like, pulled the rug out from under me and made me have to rethink that argument, because I really kind of got genuinely uncomfortable by the way that he was shooting the destruction of the city.
But it was a lot more flippant.
Exactly. He didn't have that. He specifically evoke 9/11 imagery, like where you have, you know, the photography being done from the citizens' point of view. They're running away from billowing clouds of smoke as the buildings are crumbling behind them. When the, you know, Zod gets punched through a building, it looks very much like the airplanes. And I said, okay, if you're putting me here, what am I doing here? You know, if you're evoking that imagery, what are you saying about it? And the answer is, he's saying nothing.
It's a very long,
sustained action set piece. I mean, it's the big ultra climax. And it's, I mean, as far as the staging of it and, you know, what it's doing for the story, it's not all that different from the climax in the Avengers, in which there was just as much collateral damage, but it didn't feel as like, and then maybe it's because we're talking about Superman, who should care a lot about civilians, and he seems to, you know, he's using entire skyscrapers as an equalizer to fight Zod.
Well, see, I have one thing about that. The one big difference is in those two scenes, okay, in Avengers, for example, you have Captain America who goes in and he's saving, you know, people in a bank and doing some other things for the people down on the ground. You don't just have Thor swinging his hammer around, destroying every freaking building. In fact, I would go to say that, yes, they destroyed some buildings, but it wasn't to the degree.
No, it wasn't like 5 or 6 city blocks.
And I think it's good, you know, one thing with Avengers 2, not Avengers 2, but as well, but Avengers as well, is that, you know, they did show the people and that there was consequences. In this movie, they showed the people, but they showed no consequences.
Well, it was weirdly done because he wants it to be as, like, fun and rousing and as the Avengers climax, but he also wants it to be gritty and dark and realistic because that's the tone of the movie. And there's a huge, weird grinding of the gears that happens in that fight scene. And the whole time I was just like, can we please move this out of the city? Like, because I'm genuinely thinking, like, oh, there's a skyscraper that just went down. There's thousands of people.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about Superman, it's just like, it's like, if I could see him, like, actively trying to move the fight out of the city, then I could buy some of that destruction. But where he's, like, doesn't seem to think about it at all, and you're right, there's a scene at the, you know, at the end of the fight where he has to make this big moral choice between the lives of, like, a few other people and saving them, he has to take a life. And it's like, you can't be making that argument now.
Yeah. There's something that goes against the logic of everything that the movie's already shown.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's not one thing, it's a lot of little ones. And I wish I could have, right after the movie, you know, just, I should have listed a lot of them down on paper. Because I mean, I had a bunch. I went with a group of friends to this, actually.
Okay.
And they proposed a lot of the good ones, too. And I was like, yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, I
will say this to add, though.
Sure.
Superman sinking in skulls was pretty fucking cool.
Yeah.
exclamation point. I'm not going to lie. That was a cool scene.
There's a lot of
visual-wise.
Yeah, there's a lot of striking visuals in this movie. And you know, we've been beating up on the movie quite a bit, so I'll try and balance that with some of the stuff I like. I like the middle act. I think they get the origin very well done. And I think Kevin Costner is probably the most surprising performance out of the entire movie, and he really becomes sort of the heart of the entire thing. And I, like, literally, like, got emotionally invested in him and Clark's relationship, and I've never been emotionally invested in anything Zack Snyder's done.
Well, I thought Gladiator, too. I thought, what's his name?
Russell Crowe. Yeah, no.
Russell Crowe, there we go. I thought he was, no, I thought,
there's
I thought
a,
the whole
there's
father-son
a lot of,
aspect in it.
Yeah, a big aspect of this movie, and maybe they released it on Father's Day weekend because of this, a big theme of this movie has to do with paternity and fatherhood. And knowing where you come from and your roots and all of that stuff. Another big aspect of this movie, another big theme, is this idea of repression, that he's not allowed to be who he know he can be for fear of exposing himself. So he always feels like he has this kind of bubbling rage because he can never express his potential. And I thought that was really interesting. And I think Henry Cavill is really great as Superman. I think he looks like a Superman drawing. And I think
his pecs and shoulders are immaculate.
He's a very attractive man.
Just say it.
Yeah.
But
he gets that humble quality too. He's the most powerful thing on the planet. But, and you know, I think the script cleverly writes in a reason why he has to be that humble, because he's turning himself into the military when Zod says, I'm going to kill your planet if you don't turn this guy in. And so I think he has to reassure everybody that I'm on your side. So he can't act like he has a lot of bravado. And it kind of reinterprets that Boy Scout quality that Superman has.
Also, they showed the bullying, of him as a kid. And he had to hold back, because if he didn't, he'd punch their heads off.
Yeah. I mean, that's you could say that that's lifted from X-Men, and there's some stuff in there that definitely feels kind of X-Men-y. But I think it's done really well.
Well, I think it works for the character when you're the ultimate, you know, the strongest thing in the universe, almost. To have to hold back and not really, you know, not really go for it. I think it really worked. And I think the humbleness you're talking about.
Yeah.
I think the psychology of that really works well. But I've really got to chalk that back up to screenplay.
I give that to a lot to Cavill too, though, because I think the movie in general is cast pretty well.
I agree, but like I said, I liked Amy Adams as Lois Lane, but anything from the newspaper, almost the whole newspaper thing, was a thread that I thought was very dangly and unnecessary.
Okay, see, I thought that she was integrated pretty cleverly. I didn't have a problem with her use in the plot. And then, you know, I won't say it. I guess this is a spoiler. I don't think it is. But their relationship is very different in this movie than it has ever been presented before. And I didn't have a problem with that choice.
I didn't have a problem with any of those choices. I just think it was never developed to a point where it was actually useful.
Okay.
It could have been anybody trapped under those buildings. It could have been anybody. And some of the reasons why she was around, like the military base and things like that, I was like, okay, I guess.
Would you say that she's more or less annoying than the Rachel Dawes character?
Less.
Okay, thank you. Because I still think that Rachel Dawes is one of the most annoying screen characters ever written.
Okay.
I
never had a problem with her that much, but I think Amy Adams does bring more.
As an actress.
Does bring more as an actress,
yeah,
than either of the actresses for The Dark Knight.
Yes. Sure, sure. So yeah, basically, I enjoyed the movie. I still, you know, when I write my review, I'm going to give it a positive review. But I think my reservations about it are that really for me, it's all in that last act, that final fight scene, when the proverbial rubber has to hit the road, and then Zack Snyder gets to do, you know, his gloves are off, and he gets to do what he's been wanting to do the whole movie. But I think that it's still a valid reboot, and I like, in general, I like the direction that it's going for Superman. Yeah, I hope that some of those concerns are dealt with in future movies if they continue with them.
I'll say okay. I still don't know. I have reservations. I'm half and half about it. I think I overall enjoyed it, I think. But there were, like I said, there are definitely things in it where I'm like, I'm not sure about this. So, I don't know. I actually hope, I know it's hard because it's Superman, but I wish they'd go smaller.
No, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, I know.
No, it's probably the next movie is going to be fighting Doomsday or Brainiac, or something even bigger.
Well, not what we have. Well, with Justice League, you kind of have to do something like that. But I mean the next, like, if they do another Superman movie, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Well, you're right. They're never going to do that.
No, smaller. The direction is never to go scale it back in these things anymore.
Well, you know, Joss Whedon promises, but we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. Well, that leads us into our final review about another alien come to Earth. I really didn't plan it that way. And that is for the glam rock opera biopic retro, I don't know, 70s nostalgia, whatever you want to call it, called Velvet Goldmine. This was directed by Todd Haynes in 1998, and it stars Jonathan Rhys-Meyer as a young musician, rock star, who's a lot like David Bowie.
It's not David Bowie.
But it's not David Bowie, but it's
essentially David
it's,
Bowie.
It's essentially David. And his name is Brian Slade in this movie. Christian Bale another very young performance from him, even pre-American Psycho, I think. He plays this journalist named Arthur Stewart. The story takes place in multiple different timelines, going all the way from the childhood of Oscar Wilde into the mid-80s. Christian Bale plays this journalist who gets this gig, this writing gig, to look up and find out whatever happened to Brian Slade. And he secretly was a huge fan of his and was kind of involved in his world of glam rock, bisexual, glitter debauchery in England at that time. He has kind of a personal investment in the story to find out what happened. So it kind of has a very Citizen Kane-like plot structure where he's going and interviewing all these people from Brian Slade's life, trying to track him down. He runs into Ewan McGregor, who plays a very Iggy Pop-like character named Kurt Wilde, who carried
out... But isn't Iggy Pop, but totally is.
And it kind of goes into their relationship and their kind of tumultuous, both creative and sexual relationship that they carried on in the 70s glam rock period, kind of proto-punk period in English music. And it kind of is a celebration of that. It has a lot to do with sort of the burgeoning of the early gay movement in pop culture in general, and what that looked like before AIDS scared all of these musicians back in the closet. And it has a lot to do with kind of what it is to be a fan and what it is to, grow out of something but have an affinity for it at the same time when you're looking back at it. It's a lot of different things, and it's really fucking weird. What did you think of it?
I totally agree. It was kind of strange. It was a strange experience.
Yeah.
I knew what I really gleaned from it. It did kind of make me want to learn a little bit more. It did make, I guess, kind of, portray nostalgia.
Yeah.
And make me want to be nostalgic about something I've never really been a part of.
Yeah.
Never been a big fan of Bowie or anything like that. Iggy Pop, I've always had, he's always been kind of in, he's been there. I've listened to a few of his songs and stuff there. I haven't listened to him extensively, though.
Sure.
I know his influence into a lot of music I like, of course, but
yeah.
I guess this part of the glam rock or whatever, I didn't really know that much about.
Uh-huh.
The Oscar Wilde stuff, I could kind of see the tie-in with the whole I'm gay and want to be, like, famous or, I don't know, like, popular or something like that.
Sure.
I'm not really sure.
It
didn't really tie in. It didn't really do what it needed to do, I don't think.
No, I agree. That thread was half-baked.
Yes. And then on top of that... I don't know, Christian Bale's, it became more interesting later. At first it was really boring, his plot thread.
It definitely felt...
There was definitely parts I liked, and there was definitely parts that didn't work, which is kind of funny, because our last review.
Yeah.
the other parts that didn't really work were the music. Like, sometimes it worked, and sometimes I'm like, I don't get what this is supposed to be, like, saying, really. Maybe if I knew more about the music scene at the time, maybe I'd get it. But to me, it was just like these little stupid music interludes.
Yeah. Well, I think this movie is kind of a musical of sorts. Not a traditional, everyone breaks out and starts singing about the plot, but
yeah.
I think he's using music in kind of this almost transcendental psychedelic way that the plot sort of flows in and out of these, almost very much like a movie that would have been made at that time, the way, like, say something like a Beatles movie like Yellow Submarine or something like that. It kind of has that sort of or Tommy has that kind of feel to it, the way he
okay,
uses
that
music.
Makes that yeah. makes more sense. I didn't connect that does make a lot more sense though.
Yeah, I think that's more him just kind of playing around in genre. Then I don't think, I mean, it does have thematic purpose, but I don't think that it's, I think it's ultimately more for style and energy.
Agreed. At times I kind of under I worked to me, and at times it was like, especially at the end, it seemed like they did it like a lot more often, and it was just kind of random, instead of being like, oh, this leads into the atmosphere and has more of a point to it.
Yeah, well, and some of the music is better than others. I mean, all of the songs that are written for Fake Bowie, they're kind of, I mean, I know that, you know, like, they brought in a lot of real musicians to help write those songs because they couldn't ever get the rights to real Bowie songs. and you can tell that they're almost ripping off specific Bowie songs in parts. And it kind of a little distracting when you notice that, and you're like, oh, they really wanted to have, you know, Life on Mars or Starman or something in this part, but they have to do kind of their fake Walmart or Kmart version of it.
Okay, yeah. No, that as well.
I think for me, I like this movie okay. I, as much as I like any Todd Haynes movie, which is, he's a director I think I respect a little bit more than I liked, because he's so ambitious and he's so strange and he's so, you know, he just wants to blow the three-act structure out of the water, and he's a very creative director. But
remind me real quick, what else has he done?
He did a film. He was part of the early 90s independent explosion movement, specifically an offshoot of that movement called the Queer New Wave, that also introduced directors like Gus Van Sant and Greg Araki. And his first film was called Poison, which was a triptych anthology movie where he does a gay story done in a different genre, one of which was like an old-style horror movie, and another one was like a prison movie and blah, blah, blah. Later, he did movies like Far From Heaven, which was his ode to Douglas Sirk melodramas from the 1950s that he shoots almost exactly like one. Most recently, he did the movie I'm Not There with the Bob Dylan biopic, where five or six different people play Bob Dylan. So he's a very experimental director, and he gets to play around a lot in this movie. And I think this movie is the most fun of his movies because he's not dealing with like really heavy subject matter like AIDS. But there are some shortcomings, and I think the biggest one for me is Jonathan Rhys-Meyer as Brian Slade, a.k.a. David Bowie. I think he's a very cold actor, which isn't necessarily a problem, depending on what he's in. When he's playing, you know, King Henry in The Tudors, or he's playing, you know, his part in Match Point, where, you know, you're never quite sure what psychologically is going on with him, then that kind of coldness works. But I think the charisma and the stage presence that he's supposed to have here as basically David Bowie, I think he doesn't quite ever have that appeal.
Right.
And for me, that was the biggest shortcoming of the movie. I never was totally drawn into the man, the myth, the legend that he's supposed to be written as, because Jonathan Rhys-Meyer just seemed a little too, the role was a little too big for his ability at that time.
Well, I don't know if his ability, I think, or his, like, I don't, there are people that, I mean, yes, there are actors who can break the mold and do whatever kind of roles they want, but then I think that there are a lot of actors that just plain and simple, they've got a quality to them that they can't necessarily break out of, and I think you talked about that quality, and I don't think that even at this day and time that would be exactly the right part for him.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, yes, he's got this weird, strangely beautiful, whatever quality to him. But, yeah.
He kind of has, like, an icy beauty to him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like the man ice queen.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess you could just say ice king, but I liked my version better, so.
Ice prince.
Yes, he's an ice prince.
No, it's true. And, But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I basically recommend this movie for people who like really experimental, strange stuff, or if you really like David Bowie and that era of music and just like the feel of like a nostalgia film. Like, there's something kind of fun in that. And this is kind of a rock and roll, punk rocky sort of feeling movie. And Ewan McGregor does really well in his part. I think he gets to just kind of be, you know, the emotionally unhinged one. So he gets to have the most fun in the movie. But I will warn audiences, this is very gay.
Yeah, that's true.
And I didn't know how gay before I assigned it. to you.
It's a lot like Superman. Come on. A little bit. No, I agree with you. I don't think he goes overboard with it. I don't think it's really in your face, to be honest.
Well, it is, but that's
what I think he did it point. Tastefully.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about that period of time and about how, you know, for a moment there, gender and sexuality was all, like, being subverted and everyone was kind of okay with it. Like, it was kind of cool to be sort of androgynous and weird, and like David Bowie could get on his knees and pluck the guitar strings of his guitarist with his teeth. That actually happened. And nobody, it wasn't like a huge outrageous thing where, you know, right after AIDS happened, you know, it got really cut and dry. And
it made sense for that. It made sense for this movie for those things to happen. Like, to me, it wasn't. I've talked about this before. Sometimes I feel like in a lot of movies these days, they just kind of include a gay character, and he's almost token.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's correct to do, where in this movie it completely makes sense. And it's not, and I don't think it's just because, oh, we're dealing with gay characters. It just made sense for the plot and what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit post-Queer New Wave, but it's still a very much part of what that movement was about.
Sure.
And so it has kind of a, you know, we're here, we're queer, and fuck you if you don't like it, kind of energy to it. But that really makes sense with the whole punk rock, glam rock, off-the-wall style of the movie as a whole.
Well, yeah, and the movement and kind of, yeah, I mean, I don't know, to me, it just made sense for place and time.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was a strange one. What do you have for me next week?
Next week, we're gonna go a little lighter, and we're gonna do the Noé movie, Irreversible. And it's very famous for a very long scene.
Yes. This movie's been infamous for a really long time. I think John Waters has called it one of the most shocking films ever made. I've always kind of put it on the back burners because I've never known if I want to experience this. But
because you're a little worried, me too.
But we're gonna do it.
But I feel like this is the best way to do it, because at least if this happens, we can at least get it out there and feel like violated in public.
Yeah, I think we've done that to ourselves a lot on this podcast.
Yeah, kind of. Actually, I take a lot more risks because I'm gonna be talking about it, so I feel a little.
Yeah, it'll be a conversation
less afraid.
Starter. At the least.
Yeah.
All right.
At least.
If any of our listeners want to weigh in on any of the movies we've talked about today, whether it be Behind the Candelabra, Velvet Goldmine, or Man of Steel, or if you want to give us your 2 cents on next week's homework assignment, we can read that out before we go into it ourselves. You can do so by emailing us at jabberonthedrone@gmail.com. You can also get in contact with us through our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Like us there, and you can see all of the news items we post in between episodes, some of which we don't talk about in the show. Or you could suggest movies to review, or if you have any just, you know, light questions that you want to pose to other listeners. You can sub or stream us at our archives at jabberonthedrone.podbean.com. That's where I post all the new episodes, and if you don't want to have to download it or subscribe to iTunes, that's where you would go. Just click play, as they say. You can also find us at iTunes if that's your vibe, if you want to take us on the road, you want to take us in your pickup or while you jog, or if you're like me, while I'm filing. And you can find us at the iTunes Store under Other Podcasts. Type in Jabber and the Drone. We should pop up. Subscribe to us there. Be our first review. Give us a star rating and a few sentences of what you think about the show, good, bad, or otherwise. I'll read it. You can read my reviews that I write for the Bannock Alternative or the Basic Alternative, as it's being called now, and the Idaho State Journal that I do weekly at my blog, which is saladporkreviews.blogspot.com. You can leave comments there, too. Do what you do. I also have some content available on the MacGuffinPodcast.com, a cool little indie film website based out of Richard's stomping grounds up there in the Pacific Northwest. Look up the other authors under Cassidy Robinson. You can see me blow hard on a few different subjects on the industry. And Richard you can't find anywhere. Richard you can find buried under miles of rubble in what used to be Metropolis before Superman was there to protect it.
Yeah, but he decided to save that other family.
Just the one.
Yeah, just the one.
Just the one. Everybody else was fucked.
Maybe he really just has bad vision. Maybe the glasses are really...
Yeah, like... he actually needs those.
Yeah.
He put them on right after the fight. It's like, oh, damn, did I do this?
Oh, shit.
I thought
these were really big trees.
Yeah. All right, talk to you next week.
Okay, bye.
Happy Pride, everybody.